He left. I saw it immediately.
Good.
All of this was taking place while I was also working with the Trade Unity Council and working with later with the various trade union jobs that I held. I never gave up my teaching, even though I was educational director of the UOPWA previous to that, hairdressers organizers. I still continued my work at the
while you were hairdressers organizers.
Right,
still
I still
teaching.
Continued teaching at the workers' school and teaching classes. And in the late 30s, I was asked by the Adjunct Crop Director, his name was Jerome.
VJ.
VJ. If I would care to go to West Virginia to give a course, a short course for a week, to the West Virginia miners, the coal miners. And I was delighted. And I went in the bitter cold winter of, I think, 37 to Raleigh? No, it couldn't be Raleigh.
Have there been strikes there, yeah. Or they just...
It was near Huntington. No, uh-huh. It was also part of the TUC organization, Trade Union Unity League organization among the miners, you see. Mm-hmm. The miners were being organized not to form a dual union, but to penetrate the local unions of John L. Lewis and to bring greater political consciousness to the workers and to carry out certain reforms that even in John L. Lewis's time were absolutely necessary. And because I had worked with the Workers' Health Bureau and knew the safety problem of the miners, knew all about the hazards in the mines and so on, they thought I would be very good to contact them, mm-hmm. because I had a sort of working relationship with them. So I got there, and there were two young students, or I would say perhaps graduates by this time, but they were very young people, who had been assigned to work with this group of miners. They turned out to be very intelligent, knowledgeable people. I liked them very much. Mm-hmm. And we hit it off very well together. They were the ones who arranged the miners' meetings. And they also arranged for me to stay in the home of one of the local miners. And I did that. And I recall one night, when it was absolutely freezing cold, I thought I was going to suffocate from the frost, even though I had a tremendous amount of cover, you know. I couldn't keep my nostrils from freezing. It must have been below zero in the room in which I was sleeping. Mm-hmm. Even though I was covered all the way up, and mm-hmm. there was just nothing but enough of my nose to get some air. And I recall that first night I was so cold that I got up and went into the room where they had a fire going. They had one room mm-hmm. where there was a fireplace. They didn't have central heating, you see. Each room was heated right. separately, and mostly by coal stoves because they had plenty of coal. Right. So I went into and had to sleep on a chair near the fire to get warmed up. I mm-hmm. really thought that night that I was going to freeze to death.
Did those miners' wives work in clothing industry?
The miners' wives were not workers. They mm-hmm. were mostly housekeepers. They kept house. And these were Slavic. This was a Slavic miners' uh-huh. home, not a black miners' home, but Slavic. No, they didn't. You see,
they
owned the house on yes. which they had, you see, they could not buy the land under their houses mm-hmm. because the land was owned by the West Virginia, perhaps DuPont, I'm not mm-hmm. sure, but one of the big corporations. And it was understood that if ever coal was found there, they'd have to leave their homes. And there was coal running through all the area. Everywhere you went, mm-hmm. you saw this black, coal-black dust, you see. So their homes were built on company property, mm-hmm. and they were mostly shacks mm-hmm. That the miners had built themselves or had bought and then added to it. And this happened to be a fairly comfortable house. That's why they put me there, because this miner had been in the mines there. It's near Huntington, West Virginia, but I cannot think of the name of the town. The miners had bought had a strong union there, a strong local union there, and many of them were party members. So it was the party members that I was teaching, not the non-party members. You see, we would gather in this house around the coal fire.
In the house where you stayed, actually.
Where I stayed, and I think that week I gave 3 lectures. Uh-huh. That was all that we could get together, and they came. And their wives sat around, too, but didn't say very much.
Uh-huh.
And the men were all foreigners. They didn't speak English well, and I had to speak in very simple language.
Uh-huh.
But my friends, the 2 young graduate students, thought that it was very useful, and they felt that I had made a contribution. And at one point, they took me across the tracks to the black miners' homes.
Uh-huh.
And there I met some wonderful black miners and their families living in much greater poverty than the white miners were living in. And the night that I met with them, there were, I don't think, many party members. There were three or four party members, and then they invited some of the black miners to come. And I just gave them a general talk about current political matters.
Anything about black history?
No, because I really didn't know it.
Uh-huh.
I had concentrated almost entirely
on labor history.
On labor history, and I brought in the role of the black workers, you know. But our knowledge of black history was very limited in that period.
Mm-hmm.
Even though Apted had started writing by this time, the end of the 30s. I knew the
Philadelphia Survey.
I knew the Soul of Black Folks. I knew some of Du Bois' work, but I did not study them carefully,
uh-huh.
I must admit. I was interested in relating labor history with politics.
Uh-huh.
And I remember that at that meeting with the black workers, they were men, very uneducated men. They had very simple, rudimentary knowledge of reading and writing. But they were very intelligent, naturally, natively intelligent. They asked some very good questions. I don't remember now.
Uh-huh.
We had a very interesting evening with them. And they were so grateful that we came, you know, because they have very little contact with the whites other than the party people.
Was this the time that the party was into the Black Belt and economy for blacks?
Yes. Well, this is the time when there was organization going on in the South.
Right.
And that was why these people had made contacts with the blacks, you see. And we were, it was way after the Scottsboro case, and the blacks knew something about, the blacks knew something about the party role in the Scottsboro case, because that related to black boys, black young men. My recollections are very dim about this, except that I was well received, and that I came away feeling that it had been worthwhile, even for just that, you see, to have been able to make contact with them, to let them know that the world outside was thinking of their problems as well, you see. But it was just a minor thing in the week, and of course I came back quite elated. And then in 39, I think it was, they asked me again to go to Baltimore and to teach a class of black workers at Sparrows Point, which was a steel plant area. And that did not turn out well. The party people didn't give much attention to organizing the class. And if you don't do preliminary organization,
well, then it's nothing.
Then you don't get results.
Totally wasted.
And I
you
had
have
a feeling,
to get the workers to show up.
I had a feeling that there was some political reason for it, that perhaps the leaders of the party in Baltimore had differences with the leaders in the Central Committee in New York,
and they didn't really want me,
and I came really I was pushed on them, and they had a feeling. There were a couple of very noted intellectuals in that party, and they felt they could handle it, and so they didn't need me, you see. And they were very nasty to me. They did not give me any help at all, And
did they organize students for you?
Well, they started a class. It started with 8 people, but they paid absolutely no attention to the class. They never asked me what went on there. When I went to them to try to tell them, they were busy, they couldn't see me. They said, oh, we've heard the understanding is very good, but it wasn't good. It wasn't good because the people didn't come regularly.
Mm.
I was there for 6 weeks.
6 weeks?
In the hot summer. I had to spend most of my time in cafeterias because I was living at the Y. They were not paying, you see. So I was living at the Y, paying my own way. And I think I paid $10 a week for a room at the Y. But the Y was not air-conditioned. So I used to go to a cafeteria in the morning, have my breakfast there, and work until noon, then have my lunch, and then work all day because there was air conditioning
right
there. And I'd go from one cafeteria to another so that they wouldn't put me out. And then I wrote my notes, and I did my studying that way. And then we would meet after work. And, of course, most of these workers they worked at very heavy work, and they were very tired. And it was hard for me to keep their interest going, you see. And furthermore, there was no encouragement from the party itself. There was nobody that came to ask questions and stimulate the...
But why did the leadership in New York send you to a place where it was hostile?
I never found out. I reported back that it was very unsatisfactory, that I only stayed because I had promised to, that I really felt like leaving after the first two or three weeks, and that I stayed on principally because I had made a commitment. And, of course, I left my home and my child all summer long, you know. I think that by that time my child was going to some small camp, and Bernard was working on books, and my mother was living with me, so she was preparing his meals and so on. So he wasn't handicapped particularly, and we were constantly in touch. We wrote to each other every day. But when I told him how little I had achieved and how disappointed and aggravated I was about the whole situation, he said, well, it was just a waste of time. You shouldn't have done it.
Did you tell the leadership when you came back?
Yes, I told them, but they did not explain anything. They made no explanation. They listened, and I didn't know whether they felt it was my fault or whether they felt that it was their fault, you see. I had a feeling.
They weren't willing to discuss it,
though. They were not critical of me. They didn't say anything about my work. And they didn't say anything about the leadership. They were absolutely silent. And after I had finished reporting and telling them how poor it was, how it started with 8 and it fell down to 6, and by the time I was leaving, there were only 3 people who came from the original 8. And occasionally they would bring friends or somebody, you see. But it was really very, very bad. Mm-hmm. And I was terribly lonely there. I had no friends. I met Margaret Schlauch, who was teaching at Johns Hopkins, and we had dinner together. And here and then, there, I met somebody that I knew. But the party people made no effort whatsoever to...
And you never found out?
To accept me.
It was a contempt for intellectuals?
No, it was not. It was a... It was basically an antagonism to the fact that I had been sent there. Perhaps they were not even consulted. I don't know what the thing was.
It was just the way the party worked.
It's the way it was working. And it was also the rivalries that existed between the various people in the agitprop department. And I couldn't put my finger on what it was. I never did find out.
Did it disillusion you at all?
No, it didn't. I was never discouraged by these things because I was so aware of the fact that these matters existed, and I just felt that I wanted to keep on going. I didn't care what about these party rivalries and these differences that existed. I didn't want to be part of that. I wanted to be someone who contributed in whatever skills I had. And so,
had you written the film
when I left
by this time?
No,
oh.
No. I was working on it, but I hadn't yet written it. I wrote it in 1940. I remember that I was so angry at the end that I don't think I even came to say goodbye to them. I saw them during the week before I left, and I said, you know, this is my last week. And they said, oh, yes, we know. And they never asked me what was wrong or what was right or how they could help me to improve the class or what they could do to get more students. They were always busy. They were always running into little back rooms for meetings. And never having time to discuss this. And I did not look upon it as anti-woman, but rather as some sort of inner party differences that, mm-hmm. In which I became the target, in a sense, you see. So that was one of the most unsatisfactory mm-hmm. experiences that I ever had in the movement. I never experienced anything quite like mm-hmm. that. And to this day, I have steered clear of meeting any of the Baltimore people for that reason. I've always had a feeling that they were rather petty.
Uh-huh.
And two or three of them were intellectuals, actually, were uh-huh. not working class people at all.
Uh-huh.
So if they had any kind of contempt for the, you know, for intellectuals, they were themselves
uh-huh.
as intellectual as I was. Anyway, now I will say this, that all during the 30s, I had great personal conflicts. And the conflict centered around whether I should be an activist mm-hmm. or a researcher and writer. And I think that this reflected itself very much in my work.
Mm-hmm.
Because when I was very active and very busy, in various organizations, I was happy, but I was always being drawn towards the other work,
uh-huh.
towards doing research and writing. And on the other hand, when I did research and writing, I was terribly unhappy because I wasn't an activist. So this kind of conflict within me continued all during the 30s. I was always being torn apart.
There was no way to combine them somehow.
Well, it was very hard to be an activist and a writer, too. You had to take time off from active work. During this period also, the Congress of American Women was organized, and I was very active in that. I was a member of the board, and I helped to draft many of their resolutions and to plan their programs.
What did they do to implement their programs? Because I looked at some of their documents, and it seemed more a paper organization.
Well,
that's the only way I saw it. I didn't see.
It was an organization, I think, that rallied most of the party women.
Mm-hmm.
And in that sense, it was good because it gave them a distinct. No, it was a separate organization.
Yeah, I know, but was the concept an auxiliary?
No, the concept was not an auxiliary.
Uh-huh.
The concept was a Congress of American Women, a Congress of women who would work on women's problems and women's rights, and who were concerned about all of the problems confronting women, equal pay for equal work. The problems of working women generally, their working
against
conditions.
ERA.
We were against the ERA at that time, yes. And we also wanted to participate in women's or other women's organizations. We wanted to have
like
a coalition.
What
well, for example, we would send delegates to the YWCA conferences mm-hmm. and meetings. I myself went to a YWCA convention in Atlantic City as a delegate from the Congress of American Women, you see. Mm-hmm. We wanted to be part of the women's, whatever
women's
woman.
Education, anything?
Yes, we had lectures,
workers.
Yes, and we wanted, we worked on that. And we wanted also to be close to the Women's Trade Union League.
The WTUL.
We conceived of this as a women's movement,
mm-hmm.
a strictly women's movement.
And they organized? That's what I meant. I mean, or did they mainly?
We didn't really go out and organize, but we advertised our lectures and our meetings,
uh-huh.
and we drew a lot of women who were not party people at all. And the
it was
Congress,
United Front organization.
It was the United Front, and also the question of fascism, the question of all the problems after the Spanish War, and the fact that we were confronting a war ourselves, and of course we were against war. And it was just one of the many United Front organizations that grew up, but it was specifically a women's organization.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to stress this because in that period, in the 30s, outside of the Women's Trade Union League, there was no known women's organization. The Jane Addams movement in the 20s, which was centered around suffrage, was still in existence, but they were a group of pacifists. It is true that they organized that tremendous ship with the Rosika Schwimmer.
Yeah,
you remember
right.
that was in the late 20s,
right.
I think,
yeah, right.
and that they were very they were active in penal reform. They worked with the socialist movement a little bit, socialist women, and there were a lot of socialist women in the Jane Addams movement. But they were not really an active peace organization, and we were. See, we were fighting for peace and freedom, and I don't recall.
What about housework? Did you talk about anything like that? Men should share housework?
No, we had a domestic workers group, and out of
organizing domestic workers?
Yes, out of that domestic workers group grew the embryo domestic workers union, which never really developed into anything, you know.
Still trying to organize.
That's right.
But what it wasn't anything about sharing housework about
we didn't have any
that men should help in the house, daycare, abortion.
We dealt with daycare, but not with abortion.
Not even with
a divorce. The personal lives of the women were always sort of secondary to the larger political problems that confronted women.
What about the women that weren't married? Or
very little attention was given.
Black women were in that
group? We attempted to organize black women, and then there was, you know, an organization, the Negro... What was the name of that?
Negro Women's
the Congress of Negro Women.
Congress of Negro Women.
That is not the correct title. But it was something on that order. And we made contact with them, and we used to go to their meetings, and we used to invite them to ours. It was essentially the only women's movement in the 30s that amounted to, that got any real publicity. Now, I will say that the pacifists, the Jane Addams group, and the League of Women Voters, and the Women's Trade Union League were also active forces in the 30s, but they didn't influence large numbers of women, and they never, the Women's Trade Union League never got very close to the unorganized women. They were in the old established unions like the ILG and the Amalgamated, and they had some office workers. In fact, they tried to organize an office workers union that was parallel to the left unions. There was a great deal of rivalry
between the WTUL and the
between the Women's Trade Union League and the left.
Uh-huh.
And they were conspicuously anti-left. Rose Schneiderman was a very ardent anti-communist. But many of the communists joined the league. I was a member of the league, and they were quite frightened of us. They never would offer us any posts on committees and things.
Anne Stein was in that in Washington, and she wasn't anti-left at all.
I didn't know the Washington group.
Did you know anything about prices of food that were rising or anything like that around prices or...
I don't recall that.
You know what I mean?
No.
Consumer kinds of things.
Consumer problems were not raised at all in the Congress.
In
the trade unions, the consumer problem was beginning to arise. For example, in the Food Workers Union, in which I later became the educational director, they were already talking about having to consider the consumer and the price of food and so on when they were asking for wage increases, you see, that it would inevitably result in higher prices for food in cafeterias and in restaurants and lunchrooms and places of that sort. And they began to started to consider it, but they didn't really we were not yet ready for it. The age mm-hmm. wasn't ready for it. The epoch wasn't ready
uh-huh.
for it, you see. But they raised the question, and of course the union label was the other aspect, and the left was contemptuous of the union label because they felt that it was a gimmick to avoid better turn it off.
Okay.
I'm trying to think of the word. To avoid confrontation, and see confrontation with the employers, or going out to organize the unorganized,
uh-huh.
it was a diversion. That's what I meant, a distraction, and so we were contemptuous of it. And of course, there was during all the 30s tremendous rivalry between the Social Democrats and the Communists. And if you were on the Communist side, you would normally think of them as people who were not really working in the interests of the masses, you see.
Were there women in the Congress of Women?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. We had...
There were lots of trade unions.
Oh, sure.
And
we,
rank and file
don't forget
women.
That we had a big ILG caucus within the ILG
did
itself, a left-wing caucus.
Women into unions?
We had some left-wing unions within the ILG. Uh-huh. There were some left-wing leaders within the ILG locals.
Right.
We had a lot of left-wing influence in the ILG, but there was always the conflict, you
who
see,
were
between...
the women that were in leadership of that Congress of Women?
Well, the woman who, the anthropologist at Columbia.
Margaret Mead? No.
Oh, no. No, Margaret Mead was an enemy.
The woman's name we were trying to remember was?
Jean Welkfish. Mm. But G-E-N-E, yeah, Welkfish.
Who started the women's, who was very
active
in the women's conference.
She was later. She became later the head. The president of the
mm-hmm.
Women's Congress, and she was president through the 40s,
uh-huh.
and then the Congress practically disbanded at the end of the 40s.
I think when Elizabeth Gurley Fenn went in jail, it was in the 50s, it just disbanded totally, and now they've rejuvenated it.
What, the Congress of American Women?
Yeah, they
really?
Have now a special something for women.
I see.
Recently, now that the women's movement came up again.
Well, there is room for a left-wing yeah. women's movement because mm-hmm. there isn't anything now in the women's movement. Now is certainly not a left-wing.
No, there are some socialist feminist organizations.
Yeah, but they could coalesce into one large group. Anyway, Jean Welkfish became the president later, I believe, during the war. But before the war, I cannot think who the president was. I could find out,
uh-huh.
however, there are some people who might
it
remember.
Wasn't a feminist orientation, though.
It wasn't a feminist orientation,
but it was a
women's orientation,
mm-hmm.
and it was concerned largely with the political and social problems of women and not their personal problems.
Mm-hmm. Not even abortion?
No. We all recognize that it was premature to undertake anything of that sort.
Furthermore, there wasn't any
real interest in the individual woman's problem. There was greater interest in the larger societal problem of women.
Uh-huh.
You see, and
but daycare, did they support daycare?
Daycare at the end of the 30s, we were talking about having daycare. We had always. The women in the party had always recognized that it was necessary to have daycare for working women, and especially when the models of the Soviet Union emerged, it was obvious that this was the proper thing. But we never had felt that we had the political strength. What's that?
Cockroach.
Hmm?
Cockroach. Yeah.
Oh. How do you do? The scourge of New York.
Right.
I didn't even see it.
Daycare we're talking about.
Yeah.
But the other issues were mainly equal pay for equal work, fascism.
The right of women to organize, the role of women in unions, the fight for leadership of women in unions. This we emphasized. And in general, women's legislation, we were concerned with women's legislation, you know, reforms,
protective
legislation.
Did they talk about male chauvinism? Because I had heard that people actually got kicked out of the party for male chauvinism.
Well, there was discussion of that, but it was not a principal issue with the Congress, but there was discussion of male chauvinism. There was a great deal of that discussion, and the fact that women are not being pushed into better positions.
How often did this group meet? How often did it meet? Or did it hold yearly conferences?
I'm very vague about it.
No.
It seems to me that we used to have monthly meetings, and then there were committees, and
did
I don't remember. Oh yes, I was with it all through from the very beginning, from the very origin of the committee. I was a member of the board, but I don't really remember.
You were on a labor committee, or you don't? Did they have a newspaper?
No, they didn't have a newspaper. And when Jean took over in the 40s, we were then sort of launched as a. We would have lectures. We would during the Spanish Civil War, I think there was some activity, but I'm very vague about uh-huh. it. I was so involved in the trade union aspect of work that I would come to meetings of the Congress. I would work on committees. I would help write resolutions and documents. For example, the Congress of American Women revived International Women's Day, and we were the ones who celebrated International Women's
what
Day.
What kind of you celebrate it?
Well, frequently there were big mass meetings, mostly mass
Union
meetings.
At Union Square?
At Union Square, no, never, not outdoors, indoors. We had meetings in large halls. And then we encouraged the people in the unions to organize International Women's Day celebrations. And we had materials in the press. We used to issue press releases and that kind of thing. It was faltering. It was not a really influential uh-huh. organization. It faltered because it didn't have wide support. It didn't have a broad base.
Was Margaret Lawson,
yes.
because she wrote a pamphlet on housework and how it should be divided for
really?
Men and women. Yes, I just found it in the public library, so I was wondering if
what
that was...
What year was that?
I think it was 1940, this pamphlet.
Margaret was a very dear friend of mine.
Oh.
She's a very close friend of mine.
Like
and,
people write today.
And
yes?
As a matter of fact, after her marriage to Albert Maltz,
mm-hmm.
She lived in my house for about 6 weeks because she was recovering from an operation.
She seems like quite a feminist as well.
Oh, she was an extraordinary woman. She was a feminist. She was an inspiring personality,
uh-huh.
and she had great leadership qualities. But somehow or other, she went off into the actors group. You know, she was interested in plays and writing plays and in acting. And she was essentially a dramatic type, you know, a showman type. She loved to, she used to play the guitar and sing all the Western folk songs.
Uh-huh.
We used to have her very often, you know, for entertainment. Margaret and I became very close friends, and then they went off to Hollywood. And we were in constant touch, and Brennan and Albert were very, very close friends.
You see, because she wrote this pamphlet about wages for housework.
I didn't know that. Is that so? But under whose auspices? And who published it?
Workers' Library.
Publishers.
Right.
Workers' Library.
And then I know Elizabeth Gurley Flynn wrote a reply against it.
Really?
Yes.
I didn't
And it was
that.
About wages for housework.
I don't
she
remember
felt
that at
the
all.
So I was just wondering if that was discussed.
Yeah.
The housewife should get wages.
It must have been.
Yeah.
You see, it must
right.
have been. But I wasn't terribly interested in, uh-huh. in the women's problems per se. I was really interested in mass organization.
Mm-hmm.
I felt that the period called for organization of the unorganized.
Mm-hmm.
This was the opportunity to get people into trade unions. And once they got into trade unions, it was my opinion at least, that they would develop a consciousness, a political consciousness, understanding of world politics, and would become active participants in the struggle against capitalism, you see. And
that would free women, getting active.
And that would free women, and that in itself, since there was no barrier to women becoming part of this movement, you see, it never, the women's problems per se were essentially
uh-huh.
not one of the things which interested me very much, although all through the 30s and the 40s, I participated in International Women's Day, frequently wrote proclamations or statements, or, you know, on behalf of various organizations and so on. And of course, I was very loyal to the Congress. But it wasn't my major
right.
work. You see, my major work was really in the trade union movement.
Right. And you didn't see women specifically as a potential group that you'd organize. What about women friends? Did you have close women friends that were different from men friends that you had?
Well, Margaret was one of my very
uh-huh.
dear friends, and Helen Black, who was a very close friend of Margaret's, was also a very dear friend of mine. She was involved she was not really an activist. She worked in one of the Soviet agencies for photographs and things.
Uh-huh.
But she was a very very interesting woman. I liked her very much. Oh yes, I had friends, but we did not have time for friendships,
uh-huh.
and we did not have time for sociability. I rarely had time to invite people to dinner at my home because we were both so much involved in work in writing and in other work. And then we had our child to think of, you see.
But did you talk to them about, like, personal problems that you had? Or you just didn't talk to anyone?
No. Well, occasionally Margaret and I would exchange notes about personal things. But, and then I also had a very good friend who was known as Carolyn Drew. She was a party member, but she was the wife of Wagon Connect.
Oh.
Alfred Wagon Connect. I have lost track of her.
Michigan.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. He was in Michigan. They were also in New York.
Oh.
And in fact, there was a period during the Depression.
Someone wrote a book about him.
Did they really?
Yeah.
His daughter is Helen Winter, who was the wife of Carl Winter, and
wrote
she was
about
an active
Soviet Union.
She's an active communist.
Right.
She's a member, I think, of the Central Committee. And her mother was Wagon Connect's first wife, and then I don't know whether they ever married Carolyn, but they lived together for many, many years. And Carolyn was
pressured people to get married.
No, the attitude towards marriage, I thought, was very advanced, very permissive, and even the attitude towards extramarital relations and so on. There was a great deal of that kind of thing going on all the time, and sex relations were a permissive thing. People were not judged by the company they kept. And women were
in political life.
Yeah, and there were a great many women who really did cultivate the men in the party by you know through their sex relations and so on. There were a great many women like that. There were lots of them, but we never judged them, and we never cared one way or the other. And
the party didn't intervene at all.
No, and there was no moral stricture at all. Nothing, and that I think was a rather advanced view. Yeah, rather advanced view for them. We didn't care one way or the other if a party leader slept with somebody or other, or a party member slept with someone or other. Never really meant very much to any of us.
People had to get
We had our own. My husband and I had our own moral values, you know. But we were very permissive about others. After the encyclopedia closed, we had a period of great financial trial because Columbia refused to appoint him on their staff, and he was able to get maybe one or two classes to teach at Columbia. And as time went on, it became more and more of a problem because Jews were simply not acceptable in faculties anywhere. And he had marvelous references, especially his encyclopedia experience.
And he could not. Anti-Semitic period.
There wasn't.
It
was not only an anti-Semitic period. It was a carryover from the previous periods. There had never been in America an acceptance of Jewish faculty members. Jews came into universities largely either as mathematicians or occasionally as scientists, but never in the field of sociology or even anthropology. Boaz, I think, was the first Jew who became prominent in anthropology, and he succeeded in getting quite a number of Jewish anthropologists into various jobs because of his prestige and his status. But in sociology, it was almost an unwritten law that no Jew would be hired in sociology. I think I mentioned in one of my earlier tapes the attitude taken towards Jews, that they were biased. And you remember the incident with the president of City College.
Right.
Well, all through the 30s, my husband was applying for jobs which he knew were vacant as a sociologist and would get continued refusals. And it reached a point where he almost gave up in despair because there was not a single university.
And you were willing to go outside New York?
Yes, there was nothing to keep us from leaving the city, but no university would accept him. As a matter of fact, one of his close friends who attended Columbia while he was getting his PhD was a minister whom he knew very well, who was very tolerant towards the left. And this minister became the head of Fisk University, which was a black university. And when he left, my husband said, I would like to teach at Fisk. And this minister was not committed. He said, I'll see what I can do. He knew that Bernard was not able to get a job. And when he got to Fisk, he had an opening for a sociologist and did not invite Bernard, although we were very close personal friends.
Do you think it was anti-Semitism or anti-left?
It might have been a combination of both, yes. But the fear of Jews was that they were left, you see. There was great fear that Jewish sociologists would necessarily be socialists, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And so they steered clear of Jewish sociologists. And so all through the 30s, he was not able to get a post. And finally, then he just started writing, and we used to live on his writings, you see.
What kind of things?
Well, he did syndicate writing. He used to write columns on evolution and on anthropological subjects under a pseudonym, you see.
Oh.
And they were and he syndicated them.
Uh-huh.
And he did pretty well, and then he got a job writing this book on the family, which later became rather well known, for the Progressive Education Association. And it was through the head of that, or Education Association, whose name I know very well, but I can't think of, he got recognition in many of the colleges. And he used to be invited to lecture, you see,
uh-huh.
but never given an established post. And finally, after much pressure at Columbia, I think it was in 38, that he was assigned a teaching post in the School of General Studies,
mm-hmm.
but without rank. And and he did so well. He had such large classes. I think it was 36 that this happened.
Uh-huh.
Now,
during Spain.
Well, it was before,
yeah.
A little bit before Spain, yeah. Coincidental with that came the founding of Science and Society, and he was one of the founding editors.
And that was in 36?
That was in 36, yes.
Uh-huh. Right.
When he died in 56, he had been a founding editor and chairman of the board of editors for 20 years.
So it was his idea?
It was his idea along with others. He was not the only one, but he certainly was a staunch promoter of it.
And the purpose was?
The purpose was to spread the Marxist ideology in universities.
In a non-communist associated way?
That's right. It was not associated with the party in any way. It was an independent effort to make Marxism a respectable discipline within the universities. And this was my husband's dream. It only happened after. It only happened in the 60s.
My peace courses in Marxism.
Yeah, after his death, you see. But this was his goal.
Uh-huh.
And he wanted to stay in the university for that reason. Now, the other people, there was a high school teacher on that, they didn't teach Marxism in their courses. They were just, one was an English teacher and the other was, I think, a math teacher in the high school system,
because uh-huh.
that was better paid, you see. And high school teachers who had PhDs often taught. The two members on the board of Science and Society were both PhDs who taught in high school because they couldn't get into university teaching, and they were brilliant men.
Because they were leftists?
No, because they were Jews.
Oh. Mm.
They were not even known. They had never been activists. Like
uh-huh.
My husband was more of an activist because of his participation in the student movement
uh-huh.
in Colombia, you see. But these men were not. They were not activists, but they were left.
Uh-huh.
And they were Marxists. And then there were two or three other people on the board. And it was a very brilliant group of men who formed the magazine, which has lasted until this day.
Did you work on it at all?
I used to... No, I would say no, although very often Bernard would bring home an article and he would be in doubt about it, and then he'd ask me to read it,
uh-huh.
and I would, so I was informed. And then they very often met here at my house, so
uh-huh.
I listened in on their discussions, but I never was an active,
uh-huh.
I never was an editor or an active participant, because I was involved in other things.
Right.
And I did want to keep things separate, because I wanted Bernard to feel that he was that this was his work, not mine, you mm-hmm. see. I don't think he felt that way, but I did.
Uh-huh.
And it was great. It was an education for all the people who were on it, and it was a fascinating job. And of course, all during the 30s and 40s, Bernard pushed the magazine very hard in all of the academic meetings. You see, he really was the lone Marxist, an outspoken Marxist. And that was one of the reasons that they appreciated him in the sociology department here, because he never hid anything, you know. Uh-huh. He always came out and said, I am a Marxist.
And then they hired him in general studies.
They hired him in general studies.
Without rank.
And without rank, but with, I think, at first an assistant professor's salary, and then it went up to an associate uh-huh. professor's salary. And when towards the end of his life, they included him in everything. I mean, he was a sort of a professor without portfolio,
uh-huh.
you know. Recognized.
But he never taught at the graduate school?
Well, he never taught at the graduate school, but he used to attend...